Members, let's get started with the Government Operations Committee. I think they need one more for a quorum. So Representative Murphy, if you want to come down and start presenting your bill. And members, there's a DE2 amendment that we're going to be taking up, so when we get a quorum here. So why don't we discuss that? And there's also in the packet, there's a A13 amendment, which is a technical amendment that from when the DE2 amendment was drafted, there was a couple of minor errors that were done, and this is to correct those errors. That's just to correct an error by the revisers when they were drafting the bill. We now have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting officially to order. Representative Murphy, I'll move that House File 2180 be referred to the Committee on Education Finance, and I'll move the DE2 amendment. And you want to just briefly, we'll just put it in the order you want, then you can describe the bill. All in favor of the DE2 amendment to put the bill in the order that the member wants, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. And we, like I said again, we have the A13 amendment, which is to the DE2 amendment to correct a couple of errors, and again to put it in the form that the chair or the majority leader wants. All in favor of the A13 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The ayes have it.
Nothing.
Now the bill's in the order that the author wants. Representative Murphy, please describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for being here on a Friday afternoon to hear House File 2180, and thank you for putting it in its form. We did a delete all amendment just because there were a number of line changes, and it was just easier to do it that way for our staff. And I want to give a shout out to Tom Pender, who's not here because he's been doing a lot of work on this piece of legislation. This is the Health Insurance Transparency and Accountability Act. This is a proposal that works to solve the rising cost of health care for school employees, for school districts, and for property taxpayers. And it is the next generation of work being done by Education Minnesota. And for those of us who have been here for a while, we know that there has been legislation moving through the process over the last decade that would create a school pool for school employees. This bill does not do that. After years of work on that effort, Education Minnesota has chosen to take a different and novel route, and I am happy to author this bill. I'm working with them. So first and foremost, I want to make sure everybody hears that this does not create a school pool, and instead it uses competitive bidding to try and drive down cost. It preserves the rights of school districts to make decisions about the choices, but it does ask that school districts request. They don't necessarily have to receive, but to request 3 sealed bids from health insurance providers. One of those is PEEP. PEEP is a public employee pool. It's a self-insured publicly employed pool. So a school district can go out and seek 3 bids from a service co-op, from a health plan, and 1 from PEEP. They don't necessarily need to get them back. It sets up a process for opening those bids together, and then a following process to negotiate a subset of those bids that are received. It does extend a gift ban provision to school superintendents, school board members. It provides some sunlight on the advisory committee of the service co-ops that are making decisions about health insurance. And largely, it uses a process that is currently being used by DHS and other agencies to drive down costs. Let's recall that Governor Dayton, when he took office, began using competitive bidding with our health plans to drive down costs in our public programs, and they have been successfully achieving better bids for that book of work in Minnesota and saving the taxpayers money. This bill provides that same process for the school districts, preserving their ability to make the choice, not forcing anyone into any plan. But making sure that they're getting competitive bids so that everybody's making their best offer and the school districts can avail for themselves a better price. And with that, I'm happy to turn it over to Mr. Radke, and he will share a little bit more.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Brandon Radke. I'm the Director of Public Affairs at Education Minnesota. As Representative Murphy said, Education Minnesota is always looking for ways to make health coverage more affordable, predictable, and fair for our members. We've worked on a variety of different proposals over the last decade, and today I just want to talk to you about a new proposal that we call the Health Insurance Transparency and Accountability Act. As Representative Murphy said, it focuses on three things: creating competition and increasing the number of bids school districts receive from insurance providers, enacting good government reforms, and protecting members' premium dollars. It seeks to ensure a competitive bidding process in two major ways. The first is it does so by requiring school districts to request at least three different bids for health insurance, with one of those being a requirement from PEEP, which as we see as a benchmark bid for districts to get. Secondly, the bill requires that all health insurance bids be put on the same timeline, be sealed until all bids are open, and be based on the claims data. This will ensure that providers are putting their best foot forward from the start and basing bids on usage data. Second, we enact some good government reforms. In order to even prevent even the appearance of any conflict of interest, the bill prohibits school board members and administrators from receiving gifts from people or organizations seeking to do business with the district, and it expands the open meeting law to committees or task force that service co-ops have related to health insurance. And finally, the bill protects educator premium dollars by requiring any premiums surpluses that are returned to districts to be negotiated over or used to offset premiums. A couple things, as was stated by Representative Murphy, it does not create a single-wide health pool. It does not force a district into choosing a specific plan or move them into a specific plan. Our goal with this bill is that districts would get multiple bids. We want a sealed bidding process to open up and make sure that that process is open and that people are putting their best bids forward. And we want to let districts and their employees make the best choice for themselves. We have had a tremendous amount of conversations on this bill with administrators, school boards, the service co-ops, and health plans. This has led for some very fruitful discussions, and we have agreed to many changes and continue to talk about other changes we could all agree on. Multiple redrafts of the bill and the author's amendment reflect our willingness to work with others to get a bill that is hopefully workable for all parties involved. Some of the changes that we have already agreed to as this bill has gone forward is, one, allowing for agreements to go beyond 2 years, up to five, changes to the charter school provisions so that they are comfortable with the language, narrowing our proposal on the open meeting law to satisfy some of the concerns raised by the service co-ops, and clarifying the sealed bidding language. We also propose in this author's amendment some clarifications for self-insured districts, which include clarifying the services that self-insured districts must bid for. Through our discussions, they talked a lot about a self-insured district bids for third-party administrative services not for a whole health plan, so we clarified some language that they must seek multiple bids for their TPA services and the PEEP bid. We also clarified how they must prepare RFPs, that they don't have to change and do an additional RFP specifically for PEEP, and then also adjusting the timelines to fit within a district's circumstances. We heard from some of the self-insured districts that their timelines for how they do things are a little bit different than how we had laid out, and so we maintain flexibility for districts to set their timelines as long as there's a certain amount of period that they have to be, the bids have to be opened in, and that all the bids are sealed until they're open. We are committed to continue our discussions with all these other parties and the authors to try and seek language that hopefully meets everyone's concern. We really want to focus as many dollars as we can on the classroom, and we hope that this bill passes today and will result in better insurance prices for our members and school districts saving money and premium dollars for our members. So with that, I'll stand for any questions.
I'll get through all the testifiers, and then we'll have questions all at once. Bill Hursted, I hope I pronounced that correctly. And Bob Nystrom, is that who else is coming down, both at the same time? Okay. Which one, everyone, go first, and please state your name for the record, and go from there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I wish to thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Bill Yurtsted. I am president of the Elk River Education Association, and I am one of the 850 teachers of the Elk River Area School District. And I've been an educator there for 39 years. Our district includes the four main communities of Rogers, Elk River, Otsego, and Zimmerman. For as long as I could remember, our district used the same insurance carrier, the same company. And for right now, I'd like to focus on the years from 2000 to 2009 first. During this time, during that nine-year period, our rate increases fluctuated greatly. In fact, in 2001, they increased 24%, and in 2007, they increased another 21%. The average rate increase during those 9 years was about 11%. In 2001, the health insurance costs were 5.5% of the total district compensation expenditures. 5.5%. By 2009, it rose to over 12.5%, more than doubling during that period of time. Since district contribution toward the teachers' single independent insurance plans are capped, teachers end up picking up part or most of the increase in costs, making it very costly for our teachers. In 2010, Elk River made a decision to seek multiple bids. As a result of these bids, we ended up changing our insurance carrier. We did receive a bid from PEEP at that time. The district chose not to go that route. And during the first year of the contract, we saw a 0% increase. And it was a true 0% because we kept the same plan, same copays, did not change any of the coverages. In the 4 years since we went out for multiple bids, we saw that 0% in 2010. We saw a 4% decrease in 2012. We saw a spike upwards in 2011, mainly because of some high usage. However, we are currently in a second year of a three-year contract with this company with a rate cap of 4%. Our rates cannot go above 4%. And this is quite a change from the previous several years where we saw an average increase of 11%. I just spoke with another leader from another large metro area district who said his district went out for multiple bids and they saw an 11% decrease. Elk River plans on seeking multiple bids again when this contract expires. And I'll tell you, seeking multiple bids has been helpful to the teachers in Elk River. And I hope that you'll support this bill so that all districts can see the same savings. Thank you for allowing me to share our story with you today.
Thank you for your comments. Mr. Nystrom, please state your name for the tape. And
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Nystrom. I've been a teacher in the Burnsville Egan Savage School District for 27 years, and I've served on our Labor Management Benefits Committee for 10 years. I'm here to ask for your support of this bill. In my time in our school district, we've gone from fully insured with a choice of plans and service providers to a single insurer. We've made multiple changes to our structures, adding and taking away copays. We've moved to a plan with high deductibles and a 105 plan, which is essentially partly self-insured. And last year, we made a decision to become a self-insured district. So we are in our first year as a self-insured district. As we made the decision to switch to self-insured, it was invaluable for us to have a PEEP bid for comparison purposes. Also, understand that being self-insured does not mean that we are self-managed. We still purchase the services of an insurer for their network of providers, their negotiated service discounts, in our case, a wellness program, stop-loss coverage, and maximum liability cap. This bill will make sure that self-insured districts all around the state seek multiple bids for those services. As a benefits committee, we are able to set our composite premium based on our claims history, projected medical inflation, and we need to include those fixed costs of the insurer that we contract with. Those fixed costs right now represent somewhere between 8 and 10% of our total premium. Finally, it would be healthy for us to regularly examine whether we could benefit from returning to fully insured through a PEEP bid. While I personally believe that it's unlikely that fully insured would be cost-effective for us, I've seen enough changes in insurance structures over the years that it would serve as an important data point in determining the efficacy of remaining self-insured. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak, wants to speak for or against this bill? If not, questions from the members? Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I have a few throughout the bill. I didn't have a ton of time to read it beforehand, unfortunately, but if you go to page 3, subdivision 10, I'm just wondering if this is a new standard that the school districts would have to negotiate with Ed Minnesota on some type of savings like this. Is it a new standard, or is this commonly done in other areas?
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pepin. I don't think it is a new standard to ask that both labor and management be involved in a decision like this.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. So right now in school districts are always required to work with admin and how they save, how they spend their money.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, that's not what I said. The school districts aren't necessarily having to do that, but I don't think it is a new standard between labor and management to jointly discuss these issues and make decisions.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Well, that's exactly the answer I thought I'd get. On page 3, the top of page 3, I guess, and the bottom of page 4, where it says no board member or school district employee shall receive any compensation or benefits based on incentives or other money. It's kind of a transparency thing, and I think that's probably a good idea. But is that legal now? It seems like that should be illegal already. Is this new? Are they able to do that now?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I think that it's a good idea to make sure that there's no conflict of interest, and so that's why this provision is here, and I can't speak to anything about the past. I just think that this is a good standard for this kind of work.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Murphy. I don't think it's necessarily a problem. I'm just very surprised because it implies that there's something going on now, and I was just wondering if there's been any evidence brought forward that's happening currently.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, you know, I'm not here to speak about the past. I just think that this is a good idea and a good standard for conflict of interest.
Okay.
Representative Pepin.
On page 6, the top of page 6, where it talks about the where the group health insurance plans must establish on its website the policy, must include a sealed proposal process, must, you know, basically follow the public data stuff. And I think it lists that for both the charter school and the public school section. Does that imply, I'm not sure, is that for all of the policies, or does that include PEEP? So all of them would have to provide by the same standards, or is PEEP exempt from having to provide that information?
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pepin, I think if we get to subdivision 8 of the bill on page 7, you'll see that, and maybe you've heard some discussion about this provision, there have been concerns about PEEP being treated differently. And we've worked with the health plans, the self-insureds, and PEEP to make sure that we understand how this bill, as drafted right now, would affect PEEP. And so PEEP and the other others that would be participating in this would be treated the same way. And that's what this amendment does.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Murphy. I think that's important
that
they are treated the same way. Let's see. On that same page, on page 7, I'm just kind of wondering on 7.24 to 7.26, where it talks about, and I think it talks about this in other areas, the contract can't be for longer than 2 years. And I'm kind of wondering about negotiations. And it seems like when you contract generally and you have a longer contract, sometimes you'll be able to get a better value. So I'm wondering, are you concerned at all that, I think some districts probably do maybe 5-year contracts, and I'm wondering, are we going to lose potential savings by having such a short frame in which to negotiate? In other words, are you saving money when you have to keep going through the RFP process every 2 years in cases of large districts in particular?
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I think if you look at the language, it does allow for the extension of a contract up to 5 years, and I know When I worked for the Minnesota Nurses Association, the nurses would often collectively bargain for contracts longer than 2 years. And so, you know, we've heard this concern expressed from school districts and others. And so we wanted to make sure that it could be 2 years, but if agreed upon, the contract could be longer than that.
Representative Pepin. And Representative Pepin, it's my understanding that school contracts, they can only go 2 years for teachers.
Yeah.
Other unions, that may be longer, but my understanding is for school teachers, they can only negotiate a 2-year contract. So this kind of would line up with what their contract is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, Representative Murphy, I'm reading and it says, school districts' contracts for group health insurance must not be longer than 2 years unless the exclusive representation of the largest employment group and the school district agree otherwise. So unless education in Minnesota and the school district both agree, it can only be for 2 years. So if this
Representative Murphy.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pepin.
So if the school district thinks that it's a bad value or knows that it's a bad value, they still are not allowed to have a longer contract unless Education Minnesota would agree. Is that correct?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I think that is correct. I think that contract negotiations come to a conclusion when the parties involved agree.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is probably my biggest question and confusion is, why would we need the school districts to go and get a bid from PEEP at all if we've got MNsure? Because MNsure is supposed to kind of be the end-all, do-it-all, and it's supposed to be the answer. So I'm confused as to why we would need this when we have MNsure, and also how this is going to interact with MNsure when it's fully implemented.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I think that there are groups that would be subject to this law if passed that would not be eligible for MNsure as currently construed because of their size. And I think that we have, you know, school districts already in place that are in the market getting coverage for their employees, and many of those employees won't be, because of the group that they're in, eligible for MNsure. So while the ACA is becoming law and implemented in the state of Minnesota, we already have coverage for our school employees, our school districts, through our carriers here in Minnesota, the service co-ops and PEEP, and that's why we're building on that process.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for your answers to the questions, Representative Murphy. This helps me understand the bill and the purpose for the bill. I think my final question is on page 9, just the appropriation of $1 million. And I wasn't really clear on what that was for, and then what is the expected ongoing costs of this. It seems like just another additional appropriation, but I'm trying to understand what it's for.
Representative Pepin, the appropriation is to cover the work that PEEP would be doing when asked to do an RFP for multiple school districts.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. So then, Representative Murphy, would you need to come, since they have to do this every 2 years, so then there'd be a $1 million appropriation needed every 2 years to comply with this?
Representative Murphy.
Representative Pepin, I think that we are looking at that to see if we can understand if the cost going forward would be necessary in the base. And that's something that we're talking both with PEEP, we're talking with PEEP and with others to understand.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I think this is my final question. Do you think that you'll have that information before time where we would have to vote on this on the House floor?
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, yes, I think that we'll have better information as we go through the finance committees.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy. I might have more questions later. It seems like it's a little bit, I still have some concerns with it, but it seems like it's a little bit more flexible program than, proposal than we've had in the past. So I'll be looking forward to getting more information and more feedback from all the groups involved.
Thank you, Representative Pepin.
Any further questions of members? I see another gentleman wants to come and testify. Please state your name for the tape. And
nice to see you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I represent Preferred One, and I apologize for not speaking earlier. I thought one of my colleagues was going to testify, but I did want to raise concerns. Representative Murphy and Mr. Radke are absolutely correct that we have been working very long and hard and diligently on this. We appreciate her willingness to talk with us about a number of the issues that were raised, and I think Representative Pepin hit hard on some of the ones that we're concerned about, which is the need for self-insureds to go out for bid as frequently as is in this bill. We don't think that helps the school districts, both with the cost perspective from administrative side or from the health insurance side. We'd like to see some more flexibility in that, and we will also be working and are concerned about the appropriation. I don't want to take a lot of this committee's time to discuss the details of that, but Education Minnesota and the author have been very helpful in working with us. As Representative Murphy said, this is a very different bill from what we've worked on in the past, and we're really appreciative of the negotiations and hope that we can resolve them before we get to the end of the Ed Finance Committee. Thank you.
Any questions of the testifier? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Griffin, thank you for bringing that point forward. That was one of the questions I was hoping somebody would come and testify about. Do you have a sense? I guess I don't really know and have enough information to know about how long most districts negotiate their contracts for. Do you have any additional information as to what a typical contract might be negotiated for, especially in the larger districts like I represent?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Preferred One has 17 districts that it deals with. Most of them have in the range of 3 to 5 year contracts. There are some 2 year contracts in that, but it really ranges all over the board. You'll find that most fully insured groups go out on an annual basis.
Thank you.
Mr. Redke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, we also did a survey of our school districts to find out the percentage of health insurance contracts in our districts, and we found that about 80% or more have a 2 year contract or less. So there's about 40 or around 40 in the state or 40 to 50 in the state that are beyond 2 years. And I think that's when our original bill language was a strict 2 years. And then after hearing from our members as well as some of the districts about, you know, if you can get a longer term deal and it's a better deal, why wouldn't you allow people to do that? Then that through one of the author's amendments, we added that provision that said if you have agreement, you can go up to 5 years. So that was kind of in response to some of the conversation we've had in listening to our members and those of others.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hate to put you on the spot, Mr. Griffin, but could you comment on that, on the negotiations on that section where
Mr. Chairman,
it says where admin and the school boards need to agree to it? Do you find that problematic, or is that
Mr. Chairman,
where you need to be?
Representative Pepin, we disagree with the proponents of the bill and would suggest that a complete exemption for self-insurance would make more sense. There's already a law on the books that requires it to be bid every 5 years. That's one of the areas of contention that we continue to work on, and I hope that we'll be able to resolve it. The goal, I think, for everyone, and Education Minnesota has been very firm about this, is to try and limit the health care cost increases that they've seen for their members. And if we can all work towards that, I think we're going to get there. But there are still some areas like that that are of disagreement.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all involved. I hope that I've seen this some version of this bill, I think, virtually every term I've been here, and so it would be really nice if you could, you know, come to an agreement where you're helping teachers, but you're not forcing districts into contracts that aren't helpful for their teachers. In other words, that where you can help all teachers and not just kind of help some and hurt some.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, couldn't agree more. There are those that have accused me of trying to fund my children's college on this bill. It's really not true.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Griffin. I'm relatively unfamiliar with what this process would look like, the bidding process. And if I understand this correctly, it's a 24-month history that you can look back to. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Griffin. Representative Pugh, the claims history is something that's a very difficult issue, and it's one of the concerns that we've raised in the bill. As an insurer, we don't have a complete closeout on claims until the year end of the contract. Contracts can vary from, you know, July 1 contracts to December 31st contracts and all around. So the language is trying to be flexible in the bill to say the most current year's contract information, claims information, rather.
So thank you, yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Griffin, for that response. My concern is that it's limited to 24 months. If a plan has contracted with a district, is that not true? That it's limited to 24 months. My concern is that if it's limited to 24 months, you know, might we not be benefiting from much more history that the district might have and the insurer might have?
Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pugh, I believe the language is permissive in saying that it must be the at least the previous 24 months. And I don't have it right in front of me, and I was trying to look at it before I got up here, but I believe that we can get more information if we want it and desire it.
And
Representative Pugh.
And thank you for that response. So I'm still trying to get some clarity about the bidding process, and just wondering what that looks like. In fact, Representative Murphy, if I could direct this to you, I'm wondering what that bidding process looks like. So there would be four bids, sealed bids. Those would be opened. One of them would presumably be from the district's insurer, if they've been pleased with the insurer, and how will that decision be made? Is it the lowest price? What does this process look like?
So Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the bids would be received. They'd be sealed, open, in the presence of the exclusive rep. If there were three bids, for instance, or four bids, the parties together would choose two, and the school district would then continue to negotiate with those two to get the best deal that they can.
Representative Pugh.
Yes, and thank you for that response. And so how would they go about choosing those two? What criteria, or is it just price?
Yeah. Representative Murphy.
Mr.
Redke. Okay.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, it would be the decisions and the discretion to make that decision would rest with the parties involved. So I can't imagine that they would be looking at just price. I think they would be looking at price, and they would be looking at network, and they would be looking at providers, the things that most people look at when they are looking at an option for coverage.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pugh.
Yes, and so my next question is for Mr. Griffin is, the fact that if a district would secure five bids and then be limited to select only two, would that be a concern for you?
Mr. Griffin.
Mr. Chairman, I think the proponents and Representative Pugh, the proponents of the bill are trying to make sure that in the bidding process we as bidders do our best job in putting our best bids forward the first time around. I don't think there's a huge problem with this, but the concern is that people will come in and then game the system by trying to get the first bid in and then lower it when you come back the second time. But quite frankly, there are things that change during the bidding process, and that the school district or bargaining unit might want to change as they move along. So most of the work that we're doing in the self-insured world, which is where the bulk of Preferred One's business is really around the administrative services only contract. So performance measurements that relate to how quickly claims are paid, to how quickly cards are mailed out to our enrollees and things like that are a part of all of that negotiation process. Just about everything is up for grabs in that, but I don't think this is a major concern on our part. Mm-hmm. And if I could, Mr. Chairman, just to go back to the previous question that Representative Pugh had, at line 7.14, the request for proposals must include the most recent 24 months of non-identifiable aggregate claims data. It doesn't limit us only to that 24 months, and certainly there are times when we want more than that. But once you start looking at claims data, you'll find that fairly quickly when you get out beyond 2 years, the group has changed fairly dramatically in a lot of cases, and so that's why our actuaries really concentrate on that 24-month period.
Representative Pugh.
Yeah, thank you. Those are my questions for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Any further questions of members? Is there anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2180, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill is referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
The next bill we have on our calendar is House File 1961. Representative Halverson, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The bill that's before you today is House File 1961, and you can choose how to introduce it and take action.
Representative Halverson, I'll move House File 1961 to be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Civil law. Thought he told me something different, but proceed with your bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1961 has been drafted in answer to a lot of public discussion and questions regarding the public integrity and disclosure for elected officials. And I would preface this discussion by saying I come to this issue with a strong feeling of pride in the public integrity that exists among elected officials in our state and local governments. And I'm starting from the premise that the public has an interest and the public has a right to know, but I don't take this issue of additional financial disclosure on with any feeling of suspicion or concern about the integrity of Minnesota. We have a great reputation of integrity in this state. Where we run into problems is with transparency and proving that to the public. So the bill, I can just walk through it briefly, starts out with changing some language in regard to audits and investigation for this particular chapter of law, and it changes it from a permissive may language to a must for audits and investigations from the Campaign Finance Board. I think that there's a definite expectation among the public that we are, as these standards are being held to us, we are actually being kept in check, if you will, that there is a check along with the standards that are being put out there for our disclosure and our campaign finance work. I will just say, and I'll skip around a little bit, but if you look at Section 4, in regard to those audits and the data that would be collected in those audits, it does. We did make it clear in the bill that the information that is being audited continues to be classified as private data. It's your financial data. If it's considered private, it stays private. So there's not going to be any kind of undue burden in terms of disclosure for folks. Secondly, with disclosure of potential conflicts, we as elected officials and public officials already disclose any potential conflicts. This would add our spouses to potential conflicts. And the standard of a potential conflict for us as elected officials would be the same for our spouses. And that is if our spouse was to receive a unique and substantial benefit from an issue that was before us and an issue that we were going to be voting on or a bill that we would be carrying, it would behoove us to not vote on it or carry that particular legislation. I've heard from a number of members that this is general practice among folks, that if because of what the public expectation is, they would certainly, if my spouse was going to be lucky enough to have a substantial and unique benefit from some legislation, that I would not be involved in pushing that legislation forward or voting in favor of that legislation. So I would submit that it's a standard we hold ourselves to already. I think that the public has a right to know about that standard, that we hold ourselves to that standard. Section 3 is the economic interest statement form, which we as public officials already fill out. Again, we add our spouse to this, and this is a recommendation that comes, adding spousal disclosure is a recommendation that comes from the Center for Public Integrity. Many states already do this type of disclosure. Minnesota has fallen behind a lot of other states in this level of disclosure. And recognizing that our interests, financial interests, are closely tied with our spouses, again, it meets a public expectation. In this particular section, we also add some additional disclosure for people who are public contractors, public officials who are public contractors or private contractors or work as an independent contractor. And currently, there's no additional reporting required for independent contractor. Your disclosure simply says contractor on there, and that can mean any number of things. There has been a call for folks to disclose lists of clients. I come down firmly on the notion that our clients and business relationships do deserve a certain amount of privacy. At the same point, trying to balance that with the public's right to know, we've worked with folks at the Campaign Finance Board to disclose particular business or professional activity codes so that we would know if we were gaining most of our income from real estate or the agricultural industry or healthcare as private contractors. Additionally, we would also include the spouse in that disclosure as well. And I did mention section 4 that your data regarding data classification. And then section 5 simply adds a cross-reference to the Data Practices Act for the new data classification sections that are contained in section 4. And I'm happy to take any questions. I also see that Mr. Goldsmith from the Campaign Finance Board is in the audience, so he can answer questions with regard to how the Campaign Finance Board would enforce or work with these new statutes.
Is there anybody else in the audience that wants to speak for or against this bill? Mr. Goldsmith, why don't you come down in case there are questions that it might be easier. Any questions for members? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Halverson. I was just looking through it and quickly trying to understand it, and I'm wondering just a few questions on, I guess I'll start with the list, the codes. Mm-hmm. And I know that the IRS has literally hundreds of employment codes, and I notice here there's about 31 codes. I wonder if you can tell me why did you pick these codes, which ones are missing, et cetera, et cetera.
Representative Pepin, I think Mr. Shepard could answer that question, and maybe Ms. Halverson, Representative Halverson can, but Mr. Shepard?
I could perhaps start and turn it over to somebody with more experience, but I can give you some of the rationale for the way this, the direction that I went in this particular bill, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, this particular list, as you said, there are hundreds of IRS codes. We actually started with IRS codes and saying, pick from the list of IRS codes because they're there and they're defined. However, because of the complicated nature of reporting that, I looked at paring it down a bit. And with the help of Mr. Shepard, and he could speak to this of with some recommendations. So,
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I have the IRS code here if anyone is interested. This is from Schedule C for people that have are self-employed. When I started doing this list in conjunction with Representative Halverson, I basically took the bold major headings from these lists here, not all the sublists. And then in some cases, I broke out some things that more specifically that for example, Clause 5, gambling industries, is not, that's broken out. It's a subcategory in the IRS codes. It's not a bold heading. I think Clauses 9 and 10, insurance and securities and other financial services, are broken out. We have, I think, broadcasting and telecommunications is broken out differently. And finally, at the last Clauses 27 through 27 through 30 are not things that are listed in the IRS list. They are things that were added to this bill. I can provide the IRS list if you're interested.
Representative Pappas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Shepard. Perhaps I don't need that right now, but perhaps I could get it later. But you did say self-employed, and I do see that in line 3.9 it says independent contractor, so only people that are self-employed or employed as an independent contractor would be required to comply with this under this bill, Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I might have confused it a little bit. Let me try, and then Representative Halverson can perhaps add in. This list was developed from the IRS list that's used by self-employed people for reporting their occupation. But there, in Representative Halverson's bill, there are two clauses of people that would have to report. The Clause 7, which is on page 3, lines 7 to 9, is these are anybody who earned more than $2,500 as an independent contractor would report the principal business or professional activity code from which they earned it. The clause above that, someone who... if an individual or their spouse received more than $50 in a month as an employee of a business that they owned more than 25% of, then they would also report the principal business or professional code that of that business.
Representative Pepper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So independent contractors are someone that owns part of a business. What about, say, what if my husband were a union rep or my husband were a teacher or worked for some kind of state government? Would I then have to, under this bill, report that as well?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, under the current law, any public official has to report the name, address, occupation, principal place of business, the name of any associated business. So under current law, if somebody were a union rep in the example that you gave, they would have to, under current law, a public official would have to report the name of that business and the nature of that association. This bill, Representative Halverson's bill, would expand that to spouses of public officials as well as the public official.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Shepard, is pretty much everybody covered under this, or they're, I know the codes are a little bit different, but I'm trying to figure out who wouldn't be covered, or is everybody essentially covered under this? So, essentially, any legislator would have to disclose their spouse's employer, their employer.
Representative, or Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, yes. Legislators are public officials, and so the legislator under current law has to disclose their own employer, and this bill would add spouses to that. And I should probably, Representative Halverson might want to add something to that. I'm not sure if I've said things here that are all in line with her intent.
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I think that Mr. Shepard provided great explanation. I don't need to expand.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Halverson, perhaps this is in here and I just haven't seen it yet. Does this also cover money? I know some people have out-of-state money, out-of-state property, maybe offshore property or assets. If I were to, say, have some kind of a trust fund in South Dakota, or just for example, would that have to be included and reported as well?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, it does not expand your investment reporting. Other than to say that your spouse's financial interests are reported as well. So if you currently report that you have a trust fund in South Dakota, it wouldn't change that unless that trust fund was in your husband's name rather than yours.
So Representative Pepin, you'll have to disclose that island you own in the Caribbean. That Greg owns in the Caribbean. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair.
Just a little levity.
I'm working as a legislator. Perhaps you know the salary of legislators. And just one final question. I think I know the answer, but would ex-spouses, children, anything like that be included in this as well? Parents?
Representative Halverson.
Mr. Chair, while that is a practice in numerous other states to include minor children, adult children, parents, even business associates, this bill does not go that far. It simply extends to spouses.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I might have more questions later, but I think that's all I have for now.
Any further questions? Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? If not, all those in favor, I'll renew my motion that House File 1961 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill is referred.
Thank you,
Representative Halverson. The next bill on our, we're going to skip down to Representative Freiberg's bill, 2937. Welcome to the committee, Representative Freiberg, and
thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that House File 2937 be referred to the General Register.
Proceed with your testimony.
Sure. And David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society is here to answer questions or to correct me if I get anything wrong in explaining the bill. This is a technical corrections bill for the Minnesota Historical Society. I think most of the provisions in here are pretty purely technical, but I can just walk through the sections really quickly if it's helpful for members of the committee. Section 1 relates to liability. The Department of Administration has basically already said they believe that the Minnesota Historical Society is included in this section, but this just makes it clear in statute. Section 2 relates to benefits to who in benefits for state coverage, health coverage. If you go to line 3.11, it basically removes the requirement that a Historical Society employee be salaried, so hourly employees would also be eligible for benefits. Section 3 is, I think, purely technical. It just uses the correct name and citation for a federal law. Section 4 relates to the list of historic sites that's in Minnesota statute. So if you go to page 5, it uses the correct name for the Meehan store, just updates it to what we call it now. Section 5 adds the Sibley Historic Site. The Historical Society is currently operating that site, so this just so there's no net effect, no cost to it, so it just makes it clear in statute. Section 6 just uses the technical historic name, this is another property that is currently occupied or run by the Historical Society. Section 7 is just cleanup, uses the corrects an incorrect address. The repealer relates to two historic sites that are no longer operated by the Historical Society. One is Barassa's Fur Post, which apparently they weren't actually able to find. And then the second one, Section 34, relates to the LeDuc House in Hastings, which is currently operated by the Dakota County Historical Society.
Okay. Mr. Kelleher, do you need to say anything, or...?
Mr. Chair, David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. That was a great description, and unless there are any questions, I don't have a lot to add.
Any questions from the members? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Freiberg, are the change from salaried to an employee, has there been a, are they employed full-time? I guess I'm not sure why that change was made.
Mr. Kelleher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tice, this really is conforming with our current practice. It's not a big change. Our HR folks have said that that's been our practice for many, many years to include both salaried and hourly employees if they have the correct number of hours. We are parallel with state employees. We're sometimes called a quasi-state agency, but it's really bringing the practice, bringing the language up to what our practice is to ensure that all of our employees, if they're eligible in terms of hours, are eligible for benefits. So,
thank you.
Technical correction.
Tice? Thank you.
Any further questions? Again, any further questions? If not, anybody from the audience that needs to speak for or against this bill? Seeing nobody rushing to the microphones, Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 2937 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. The bill is re-referred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
The next bill we have, or the last bill we have for today, is going quicker than I expected, but this is great. Representative Sawatsky. And I'll move House File 2569 to be re-referred to the Committee on State Government and Veterans Affairs. And no amendment. And I see an amendment here.
Yes.
And I'll move the A1 amendment. Do you want to describe what the A1 amendment does?
Yes. In a minute. Thank you.
It's a technical.
May I refer to my friend?
please phone a friend. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Darren Cordy. I am from the Minnesota Department of Education. My understanding was that this was a technical amendment that was to align the language with the standards of the committee, so to speak.
Thank you, sir. Representative Sawatzky, what does this bill do?
Thank you, Chair and members, and happy Pi Day. It's March 14th, thus my T-shirt, if you can find it. So I thank you for hearing House File 2569, and this is a request from the Lieutenant Governor, Lieutenant Governor from the First Lady of Minnesota to join an interstate compact on education opportunities for military students, and it is supported by Governor Dayton. And as a little bit of background, Minnesota is currently one of only four states not currently a member of this compact. And so today we will hear a little bit about what the compact does for the military students in the state of Minnesota.
And Mr. Cordia?
Mr. Chair, members, the Interstate Compact on Educational Opportunities for Military Children is something that was established in order to provide students from military families, active duty military families who tend to experience high mobility, to provide them with ease of access when they're transferring moving from school district to school district. Generally, in terms of the ability to enroll in certain classes, sometimes districts will require a transcript to be officially sent from the sending district to the receiving district. What this would allow is, under the terms of the compact, was a student, if they had, you know, a walking transcript, as it's called, that they would be allowed to enroll immediately. It also has some provisions that would allow students to participate in extracurricular activities without having to go through some of the hurdles that a transferring student would have to, and as well as gives districts some flexibility to take a look at what students have already completed in previous coursework in previous states, and gives them some flexibility to determine whether or not the student has to take the full graduation requirements that are in statute. Sometimes they don't always align. But the general idea of the compact is to have an agreement between multiple states that when kids are moving from one state to another in order to accommodate a military person's career, that that student isn't affected detrimentally by some of the obstacles or barriers that might be in place for them in the education system. And as part of that, as part of the compact, each state as a member state would be required to have a state advisory council. So in the spirit of the UNSession, rather than create a new advisory council, we invested the powers of that advisory council in the P20 partnership, which is an existing state council, and then would add a member to that council that would represent military families for the purposes of the compact, for issues that arise with the compact.
Thank you. And just to make sure I did this correctly, I'll move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have it. The amendment's adopted. Representative Pepin, you have questions.
Thank you. I can wait if there's people to testify. There's anybody else?
I don't think there's anyone else. So, Representative Pepin.
Sorry, I didn't see what was behind me. Gee, I don't know why people don't want to be here on a Friday.
You must not be a very good mother if you don't have eyes in the back of your head.
Good point. So, my overall concern with this bill is that I know it's supposed to be geared towards families of military, but looking through this compact and just compacts generally, I'm a little concerned about, because then we're sort of bound by what other states do. And I found this on the Military Child Education Coalition, and it's the K-12 core curriculum standards. And the core curriculum standards are generally fairly controversial. And so it looks to me like if we were to implement this and make sure that any school that had a military student coming in would comply by this, we're basically implementing core curriculum throughout the state. Let me know if I'm wrong on this, my view on this.
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I'm not familiar with the document that you have, and I'm not sure if by core curriculum, are we talking about the Common Core standards?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, so
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair and members, no, certainly this would not bind the state to enter into any further Common Core standards. As you may know, the state has adopted the English Language Arts Common Core standards, but we have not adopted the math Common Core standards, and nothing in this compact would change those standards that Minnesota students are delivered. It would just give schools some flexibility to say if a student had passed, you know, a particular class in the previous state, that they don't necessarily need to meet the graduation requirements of a particular school district in this state.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I'm not sure, after reading this whole thing and the requirements in the last few sections of how we're bound and how this compact would supersede Minnesota, I'm not sure that your evaluation is correct. Perhaps maybe I could just go through these pages and ask some more specific questions, if that would be all right. I'll start on page one. I'm just wondering why that purpose section is necessary at all. I generally don't like purpose sections, and I'm wondering if this is what's implemented in all the compact states, if they have the same purpose section or why that's here.
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, this is model language that came from the compact, the Interstate Compact Commission, and to this point it has been unmodified. We had had some discussions with them on the ability for the state to modify the compact language. They do require, as a term of membership, to have the compact in state statute. Again, there's some flexibility, I think, with the changes that could be made to it, but for the most part, I think they like to keep the compact model compact language intact in statute. So this is not language that was drafted by the Department of Education, or let's say this model language from the Interstate Compact Commission.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd be curious. I'm saddened that Representative Winkler's not here, because I know that Representative Winkler is very, very against model legislation, or at least from one group. So perhaps I'll ask him a question about that later. But continuing to look at this, it looks like, you know, we're trying to guarantee that any student coming from a military family is not going to have, in 2.19 through 2.21, it says, not disadvantaged by variations in attendance requirements, scheduling, sequencing, grading, course content, or assessment. So if I were to read that, so if a student were coming from Louisiana to Minnesota, then there could be, they have to, under this compact, then we have to, Minnesota has to guarantee that they're not going to have any different course content. Is that what that generally, how this works?
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I am trying to find the relevant section that elaborates that on that a little bit more for you. If you give me one second, please.
And Mr. Perdue, maybe the reason I'm wondering is because I don't believe right now that others, I believe that Minnesota has very high standards, much higher than many of the other states, which is why I'm always very concerned about any kind of curriculum that binds Minnesota to, in my view, the least common denominator. Because if someone's coming from a state with a lower educational standard than we have here, then when they come here and we're supposed to guarantee them that, then we have to dumb down our classes here. And so that's what I'm wondering, that section, what that means. And then, you know, furthermore, on page 2.31 on the top, it says it promotes flexibility and cooperation between the educational system. And I don't understand, if you're requiring all the states to be bound by the same curriculum, how that's promoting flexibility.
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I wouldn't say that it's binding all states to abide by the same curriculum. It's just understanding that different states have different standards. In Minnesota, as you know, our curriculum is locally set. We don't have any state governance of curriculum. Some states do. But all this would say is that when taking a look at a student's transcript in terms of courses they may have already taken, educational programs they were participating in, that districts would have some flexibility to make determinations on where a student could be placed, on what educational programs they could be placed in, and if they were absent because of deployment activities, that they would not necessarily be bound by the same attendance requirements that may exist in a local school district's policy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pretty, I'm not as concerned about the attendance policy as I am about the curriculum and what this means, especially since it's not just the 50 state, it's also Virgin Islands and Guam and America Samoa. So if they were to come here, we'd have to guarantee them, it looks like, the same educational standards, and we'd have to, looking throughout here, I know in the educational records and enrollment state section on Article 4, it says that a student has satisfactorily completed the prerequisite grade level in the local education agency in the sending state shall be eligible for enrollment in the next highest grade level in the receiving state, regardless of age. And so if a student came from Guam and they weren't able to perform at the grade level that they were going into ninth grade, but they weren't able to perform at the standards of the school, it looks like the school would still have to put them in that grade. They'd still have to graduate them, I think I saw in here, or they would have to make sure that the sending state allowed them to graduate, whether or not they'd met the basic skills.
Mr. Cordier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, I think to some extent you're correct in that if they completed a grade in a different state with different standards, they would be enrolled in our state under our standards, and then at that point they would be kind of brought under the Minnesota standards. So it's just, you know, it wouldn't require a kid to go back and redo coursework that would bring them up to that same grade level that they came from in the Minnesota standards. It would just bring them under the standards at that point, and at which point if they weren't keeping up within the course curriculum and however the district has decided to deliver those standards, and then it would be up to the district to decide how that child would proceed. But it's just when moving from one to the other that you don't have students that are being required to backtrack or be retained by virtue of moving school districts.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Padilla. On page 4, Article 7, Section C, transfers during senior year. We're just touching on this. It says, should a military student transfer at the beginning or during his or her senior year be ineligible to graduate from the receiving local education agency after all the alternatives have been considered, the sending and receiving local education agency shall ensure the receipt of a diploma from the sending local education agency. How does that serve students? So to me that looks like they come here, they come from a different state.
I believe she's
state.
Speaking of 8.7 to 8.14, Article 4. Right, the X article, at least the way I'm reading that, at Article 5.
Yeah, I have a copy that's not numbered. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the transfers during the senior year.
Yep, Article 7.
On that line 8.7.
I'm just trying to figure out how that possibly serves the students. So basically, if they can't meet the standards, they just graduate. Then we have to force Guam or Puerto Rico to graduate them, whether or not they can meet the standards we have here. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to understand how would that possibly. I want to help military kids, but I don't understand how that would help anybody.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, so I think what this requires is that it gives the student an option that if the student is coming from a sending district, they're required to move by virtue of their parents being moved because of deployment, that if the district that exists in Minnesota, let's say, you know what, this child just hasn't met the Minnesota standards, they haven't met our local graduation requirements, we're not going to give this child a diploma, then they would be required to work with the district from which they came from to ensure that, well, if it's not an option that they're going to meet these standards, can they meet the standards from which they came and get a diploma from the sending district? So it wouldn't be requiring districts locally to provide a diploma to somebody who they didn't think was ready to graduate. It would require the districts to work with the sending district to have them issue the diploma.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Padilla and Representative Swatsky, I disagree that that's a good idea or helps any student because, first of all, if the goal here, which it seems to be, is to start the process of fully implementing Common Core, and you want to have top standards to make sure that every student is college eligible, I don't know how making sure that we're just going to let students graduate regardless of they're able to meet the common standards. It's very confusing to me. But I'll move on. I do have another question. It's on that same page. And I do apologize because the copy that I highlighted was from the Internet, and it doesn't have the line numbers. But it's it looks like it's maybe like 715 or so in Article 6 on eligibility. It says a local education agency shall be prohibited from charging local tuition. What exactly does that mean? I understand there is no tuition at a public school, so does that mean if a military student goes to a private school, then the private school can't charge a tuition? Is that what that means?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I believe this has to do with when residency is established, when a child moves from one state to another. And what this is talking about is when you would have a non-custodial parent, and there was a custodial parent, and for one reason or another, the student was placed with the non-custodial parent standing in loco parentis. That would mean that the district, the way that it would work now is that child wouldn't be considered to be a resident of that district because their parent is a district elsewhere, and that's how your district residency is determined by where your parent lives. So in this situation, it would say if the child is living with a non-custodial parent within that district, that the district couldn't charge that student tuition. Because the way that it works now is that if you're a public school student living in one district and you want to go to another district in another state, you can't do that. You know, the state can't pay tuition to that child absent some kind of reciprocity agreement, but the child could attend and pay tuition. You see it occasionally here, but it's very rare.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Padilla, I'm sorry, do you live in Minnesota? Are you a...
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I do.
Thank you. I just want to be clear because this is totally new to me. So just to make sure I understand it.
And Representative Pepin, yeah, this is... A lot of this stuff is more Department of Education, and we don't normally see that kind of stuff here. But, yes, continue your question.
Thank you. And I'm not on the education committee. So if a military student were to come from Virginia and come to the Minneapolis School District, you're saying that they could be charged a tuition, or is there certain districts that they could be charged a tuition coming in? I've never heard of that before.
Mr. Cordia, why don't you explain circumstances that they can, where they could be charged tuition? I think what you said earlier was if I lived in Wisconsin and I wanted to send my kids to Woodbury, that because I don't live in the state of Minnesota and pay taxes in the state of Minnesota, I could be charged tuition for my son or daughter to go to Woodbury because I live in Wisconsin. And I think what you're saying is something similar to that. It's not something we see a lot of.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pepin, right, I think that's a fair assessment. What happens sometimes is you'll have a family who lives in one state that maybe doesn't have as great of an education system as Minnesota does, and so they go send that child to live with, say, their aunt who happens to live in Minnesota. But that aunt is not the custodial or guardian of that child. So we as a state would say, well, actually, that child's resident district is not here in Minnesota. It's in whatever the state they were coming from. So in this case, it would only be in the situation where the child was sent to go live with a non-custodial parent in a different state because of, deployment. So in those situations, this would say, well, no, you know, we're not going to look to the parent to determine residency. We're going to look to where the student is with the non-custodial parent, and then they'd be eligible for, you know, free public education.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Padilla, it's interesting because if this compact is indeed the same compact with the same language because it's model in every state, I'm not sure that all these standards apply the same way in Minnesota, so I'll have to do more research on that. I have a lot of issues with this bill, obviously. I think one of the biggest issues I have is the powers and the duties and the enforcement abilities. And so I'd like to direct your attention to Article 10.
That'd be page 11.
starting, I think, on page 11.
19.
Yeah, 19. In section A, it says to provide the Interstate Commerce Commission shall have the following powers: to provide for dispute resolution among member states. It says that in B, it says the rules shall have the force and effect of statutory law and shall be binding in the compact states. It lists a whole series of powers that I'm not comfortable with. D, it says to enforce compliance with the compact provisions, the rules promulgated by the Interstate Commission and by the bylaws using all necessary and proper means, including but not limited to the use of judicial process. Going down H, to establish and appoint committees that have the same force of power, same force of law. This is very, very heavy-handed. And for the idea that we're going to be bound by this Interstate Commission, to me, they have more, looking at this, it appears they have more power than our state laws. They have more power than our Department of Education. Mm-hmm. And not only that, they're able to establish and appoint committees. I don't know how many. It doesn't say how many. That would have the power to act on behalf of the Interstate Commission and carrying out all its powers, duties, and hereunder. I'm very uncomfortable with that. What is the purpose of that, and why is it so broad? Why is there so much broad power there?
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, unfortunately, when we went through the Education Committee, we did have folks here from the Interstate Compact Commission. So unfortunately, I'm not able to answer in probably the detail that they would have been able to. But my understanding is that, well, first of all, as a member state, we would have a representative that is a part of the Interstate Commission. And, you know, absolutely do understand some of your concerns. Those were some of the concerns when this proposal was brought to us in the first place, but and which we brought it to the legislature for them, you know, you all to make decisions on. You know, you are the lawmakers in this state, and there is some powers that are being established here in the by virtue of membership in the Interstate Compact. So that's something that the legislature is going to have to wrestle with. But I think the intent of having it this way was to make sure that there's consistent provisions and that being a part of the compact actually means something, that it's not just a piece of paper, but that you are bound by certain responsibilities, and that if you aren't following those responsibilities as a member state under the compact, that there's enforcement mechanisms.
Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, well, I'm very uncomfortable with that. And then if you continue going down in Article 11, I guess I'm kind of looking at line 14.3 to 14.10, and then there's more further on in the paragraph. You know, there's broad immunity for anybody that works for this compact, immunity that is, you know, fairly extreme and you don't often see. And I'm wondering what are they concerned about? Why is there such broad immunity where they're not, you know, required to, they're basically held harmless? The Interstate Commission shall defend the executive director, shall defend such representatives in an action. The representative or employees of the Interstate Commission shall be held harmless in the amount of the settlement or judgment, including attorney's fees and costs. So am I correct in assuming then that looking at the end of the bill, it looked like the states will be charged a levy? So if there were some kind of a lawsuit, and let's say it was in Louisiana, then Minnesota could be charged a levy to help pay and defend in such a lawsuit, since we're in this compact, if we were to be in this compact. Is that correct?
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, to speak to the dues issue first, it's not, there are rules that have been promulgated by the Interstate Commission that govern how the dues are to be assessed. And for Minnesota, it's based upon, just generally, it's based upon the amount of pupils that you have whose parents are active duty military members. In Minnesota, we have a very small population that we don't have an active duty military base on in the state, so we're talking basically military recruiters and their families. So it's about 200 students. And the compact, if for member states, the dues are either $1 per student or a flat fee of $2,000, whichever is greater. So for Minnesota, it would be a $2,000 annual fee that we pay to be a member of the compact. We wouldn't pay any more than that. They wouldn't have any authority to do a like a special assessment on us. Under of course, that's under current rules, and under this language. So there wouldn't be any authority for them to, as I said, do any kind of special assessment to pay for litigation or any other costs incurred by the compact.
And Mr. Cordia, do we have if we join this pact or this compact, would we have representation in the compact, so we'd have people from Minnesota working to make those decisions and making those decisions along with the rest of the compact?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We would have a member as a member state. We would have a representative in the Interstate Compact Commission, as well as all other member states have a representative member.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I'm not sure that I agree with your assessment, reading the rest of that paragraph, and then on to the next section where it talks about financing, and it says in Article 14, it'd be about line 17.17. Yeah, that section. In B, it says the Interstate Commission may levy on and collect an annual assessment from each member state to cover the cost of the operations and activities of the Interstate Commission and its staff, which must be in a total amount sufficient to cover the Interstate Commission's annual budget as approved each year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't. I think I would feel more comfortable if you wrote, you know, the dollar amount that you said, but it doesn't say anything here about the dollar amount, and that doesn't make me very comfortable to just say that we're going to be held. That we're going to be assessed this levy, especially when we have that whole big section on the immunity. And back up on line 16.24, it says the Interstate Commission shall not bear any costs related to any state that has been found to be in default. To me, we're taking on major legal risk with this. And then, so I'll move on to the next concern that I have, I guess, on Article 7. Line 15.2, rulemaking authority. The Interstate Commission shall promulgate reasonable rules in order to effectively and efficiently achieve the purpose of the compact. And maybe Representative Sawatsky can address this as well, but rulemaking is something that one of the main reasons why this bill is before this committee, and it's something that bipartisanly people are very concerned about in both parties, about rulemaking and make sure there's public ample opportunity for public input, and I'm very uncomfortable with allowing the Interstate Commission to promulgate these rules without Minnesota having the same opportunity. Is it, Representative Swatsky, is it your intent then to just skip our rulemaking process, or are you comfortable just allowing this compact or this commission to promulgate the rules?
Representative Swatsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pepin, I think that this has been, given that we are one of four states yet to join this compact, it has been supported by the Governor Dayton, and he has been prepped with the information before him, and it has been brought to us with the local leaders of asking and requesting the state of Minnesota to join this compact, and I think that things that are in order are there.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Sawatsky, when is this, if this were to pass, when will they be held to the standards of this compact?
It would be July 1st.
I think it would be August 1st.
Mr. Chair, because there is not an appropriation, it would be August 1st.
I think that's Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, I'd ask Mr. Corti to help out here perhaps, but on page 18, lines 4 and 5, it suggests that the compact would be effective as to newly joining member states upon enactment of a law. I'm not familiar with this, so I'm just reading this for the first time.
Mr. Chair, that does seem to be correct. Thank you for pointing that language out. I guess I was going by the lack of effective date under the language. But, yes, it would be upon the compact being signed into law, we would then become signatories to the compact.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair and Representative Sawatsky, I did actually know where that was. I was just wondering if you realized how quickly and how effectively this would take place immediately. And the reason I was wanting to make sure that that was clear was because if you look at Article 11, the withdrawal and dissolution portion of the compact, it says, if you look on 18.26, it says, the withdrawing state is responsible for all assessments, obligations, and liabilities incurred through the effective date of withdrawal, including obligations the performance of which extend beyond the effective date of withdrawal. And my concern is that there aren't enough people that have carefully read this bill, and the idea that the governor, is fine with this and wants to sign it, I'm not really sure how much of the bill Governor Dayton has read. I hope he has read it because, I'm wondering, do you have any concern about us, the liability that we would have if we were to withdraw from this?
Representative Sawatsky.
I will make sure that I will confer with the governor's office and ask him if he has any concerns with that.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being patient. I think I have two more questions. I'm almost done here. Representative
Pepin, it's important that we fully vet these bills in committee, and we have the time, so.
Thank you. That's why we ran through the other ones quickly. Okay, then, Representative Sawatsky, there's a severability clause that says if any part is unenforceable, the rest of it is still enforceable, which scares me a little bit, but I think what scares me more is B, the provision of this compact shall be liberally construed to effectuate its purposes. Liberally construed meaning it's open to interpretation, and that makes me nervous. Does that make you nervous at all, Representative Sawatsky?
Representative Sawatsky.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Pepin. Thank you for your viewpoint on that, and I will take that under advisement.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Sawatsky. I guess this is probably my final question. Or maybe it's a comment, I'm not sure yet. The last article, Article 18, binding effect of compact and other laws. On line, I think it's 18, that's number 2. Mm-hmm. It says, all member states' laws conflicting with this compact are superseded to the extent of the conflict. That just gives me a big wow. Just read that very carefully. All member states' laws conflicting with this compact are superseded to the extent of the conflict. That means we're giving away all of our power to this compact. And why on earth would we do that?
She's reading that.
That was a question.
Representative Sawatsky.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I'll take that under advisement. Thank you.
That means that other states. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm not really sure where to start, I think I'll start by saying that I share all of Representative Pepin's concerns about this bill, and just very, very concerned about it overall. The point that was just made and read aloud on 19.21, I mean, that sends the chills right through me. All lawful actions of the Interstate Commission, including all rules and bylaws, are binding, and this does supersede all of our laws and our Constitution. Just as my understanding, and this is a statement, but a question too, for Mr. Cordia and for Representative Sawatsky, my understanding is just as a treaty supersedes our Constitution, so would an interstate compact binding us to these rules and laws supersede our Constitution. And I'm wondering if your understanding is mine.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, I mean, the statute says, or the bill says that it would supersede state law. It doesn't say anything about the state constitution, so it's not my understanding that the compact would supersede anything in the state constitution.
And thank you. And so, Mr. Cordia, then my questions are with regard to the rules of the compact, and I'm wondering which rules are contradictory to our current state education code.
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, we haven't identified any laws that would be in conflict with the compact itself at this point.
Well, my question is with regard to the...
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question are with regard to the rules that would govern the rules of the compact and how those would conflict with the state education code.
Mr. Cordia, we're talking here about, you said, 200 students that currently are in the state that have transferred in that could be affected by this. We're not talking about all the students in our schools that are Tracy. It's just these students that would be transferring in when their parents get transferred in because of their being transferred through the military service. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes. It only applies to children of active duty military personnel.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, my concern isn't with regard to the number of students. I mean, if there were five students that this affected, I would still have all the same concerns. I mean, I'm looking at a bill. I don't know how many pages long it is, but 20 pages long and binding us to, you know, I mean, we have no idea what the financial liability is, to Representative Pepin's question. We have no idea that the consequences and the size of the stick that will come at us, and the just full power of the law with any, I mean, even if we decide to pull out of this compact, I mean, we have no idea what the liabilities are. I just know that it would appear that, you know, there are rules. I haven't identified all of the specifics, but no doubt there are rules in this compact that are inconsistent with, or incongruent with anyway, our curriculum and with regard to testing and standards. And I'm wondering if you can, I mean, do you have any concerns about this, even if it does only apply at this point to 200 students?
Representative Kahn, or Representative Swanson. Or Mr. Cordia,
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, we do not necessarily share those concerns about, you know, we don't see this as reducing our state standards or reducing the control that local school districts have upon issuing diplomas. It's just reducing some of the barriers that are in place within our state laws that deal with students transferring from one state to another. It's really nothing more than that.
Representative Pugh.
So, Mr. Cordia,
we'll get it right.
Another question. I'm gonna pull together my thoughts for a moment.
Representative Kahn.
Well, you know, the reassurance that I have as I read this is the fact that 46 states and the District of Columbia are currently members of the Interstate Compact and Educational Opportunity. It seems to me, when you also think about the purpose of this bill and its hardship on military families, that I don't think we have an awful lot to worry about. And when we look at the small number of students, again, that are affected by this, it's kind of exciting, some of the awful high school league stuff that we have that's affected students might not be in effect, which to my mind is kind of good, and it might set an example, and we get rid of some of those for the rest of our students. But I think we would have had a nationwide scandal if any of the things that people that are worried about would come place. And I'm very comfortable with Minnesota not being an outlier and doing greater mistreatment of military children than 46 other states and the District of Columbia. So I think we should be comfortable and pass this bill. And so this has been going on since 2008, and you think that some problem might have come up in one of those other states, if all of the problems you're talking about exist.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn reminded me of where one of my previous thoughts was with regard to this bill. I'm wondering, Representative Sawatzky, what kind of feedback have we received? My first question: what kind of feedback have we received from any of the military families in Minnesota who have transferred into Minnesota from another state, and the struggles that their children may have had?
Representative Sawatzky.
I'm not aware of any.
And then I would...
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask, Mr. Cordia, do you have any experience in feedback with regard to that, specific to Minnesota?
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, I really wish I'd planned ahead a little bit more and had some of our folks from the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon come and speak to that. There are a lot of organizations, well, not a lot of organizations, there are organizations out there that help facilitate this process who are very supportive of us entering the compact. So I can't say that I've personally spoken with a military family on this, but I know that folks that do that kind of work out in the community, like Beyond the Yellow Ribbon folks, do support the compact.
Thank you for that response.
Ms. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that response. Ironically, I'm an active member of the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and I have heard nothing within the organization about this initiative and the need for this initiative. And, in fact, I have... I'm thinking of one particular person, a constituent, who is very, very, very actively involved and who has... major concerns about Common Core and about, you know, I'm just really disturbed that I haven't heard anything. And here we are. I'm actually quite disturbed based on the fact that this bill will be law upon signing. Is that what I heard, Mr. Cordia?
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair and Representative Pugh, I think what the language says is that when the compact is signed into law, that the state would be bound by the compact.
Yes, and so in addition, thank you, Mr. Chair, and so in addition to my significant concerns about the liabilities, again, on lines 18, 26 through 29, the withdrawing state is responsible for all assessments, obligations, liabilities incurred through the effective date of withdrawal, including obligations, the performances of which extend beyond the effective date. I mean, in addition to that, you know, I'm just so concerned that Minnesotans are not aware of this, and here we're obligating ourselves in such a big way to a compact that is going to supersede our state law. So I'll end with that comment of disapproval that we're entering into, apparently about to enter into an agreement.
Mr. Cordia, I guess I see this slightly different than some of our members here do, having a brother who spent 20 years in the military, who went from state to state and base to base, sometimes during the middle of the school year. His children were affected by this. This was long before the pact. His children were adults by that time, but they were affected by that. They were switching schools and going into different school districts from one to the other. So I see this as a good thing that helped those students to stay on task to graduate, stay on task to get their education so that they can move on with their lives. And I see this as a good thing. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you for saying that, Chair Nelson. I was going to go along those lines as well. I mean, I think it's helpful to look at the purpose section of this law. I know we don't always have purpose sections in laws in Minnesota, but I think, you know, the purpose of this law is to help military children who move around all the time. You look at line 2.17, the purpose of this is to ensure that those students are not placed at a disadvantage due to the difficulty in the transfer of education records from the previous school districts or variations in entrance or age requirements. The purpose is to ensure that they're not disadvantaged by variations in attendance requirements, scheduling, sequencing, grading, course content, or assessment. I don't, you know, there was a question about whether veterans groups are supporting this. I don't believe we have any veterans currently in this room on this committee, but you know, I know this was heard in education policy, and Representative Leidiger, who is a veteran who I serve with on the state government finance and veterans affairs committee, was a big supporter of this. I think, as Representative Kahn ably noted, the fact that 46 states, presumably all with very different political alignments in those states, all supported this. And since it's a compact, they have to basically adopt it verbatim, is my understanding. Otherwise, if there are variations in the language from state to state, it would likely not be enforceable. The fact that 46 other states have supported this language verbatim also gives me a fair amount of comfort. And I think, you know, I think we need to help out military families and students of military parents.
Representative Kahn.
I could give an example reading through this that might have happened in my own family, except we were not, I was in a military family, but not a moving military family. And when a smart kid and smart grandkid, and so my daughter actually went to school a year earlier. She was admitted to school a year before whatever the cutoff date. When she tried to, first of all, she blamed me for everything that went wrong in her life with doing that, but yeah, that's what you get. By the time her daughter was old enough to go to school, she, you know, and she could, like, read at 3, and so the question is, why can't she go into kindergarten when she misses the day by 4 days? And so she tried to get her to have early admission. The school district, which was in Oregon, was very rigorous about not allowing any early admission. But they said, okay, we'll administer a test, and if she gets 100 on the test, we'll let her in for the early admission. And I noticed that this has things like admission dates. Well, she took the test, and she missed one question on the test. And the one question on the test was, they had a picture of the kitchen, and she had to identify everything that was in a kitchen, and they didn't have a dishwasher in their kitchen, and she had never seen a dishwasher. So she didn't get in because of that. So this is the kind of thing, you know, I mean, it wasn't a military family, but she could have been in a state that allowed early admission. They would then be transferred, and she would then be could be thrown out without that. So this is just the kind of, I mean, you know, she survived anyway. She just hung out at home for another year. But, you know, that's the kind of thing of the differences that you can see from state to state, which I don't think a military family being involuntarily transferred ought to be subject to. Just imagine, kid would have been started in school, get to another state, and then that state says, sorry, you're not old enough to be in school, we throw you out.
So, Representative Kahn, does your granddaughter follow your daughter and blame you for all of her problems? don't have to answer.
probably does her mother. Of course, she graduated first in her high school and is now doing really well, so it maybe was good to keep her out for a year, but who knows.
Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of comments. First of all, Representative, I completely agree with the purpose of this bill. I mean, I appreciate your, you know, having drawn attention, and it's nice to see a purpose on a bill. And yes, I mean, I absolutely agree with this. I find suspect 20 pages of this detail that is will bind us in ways that I'm afraid we can't imagine right now, and not to mention the financial consequences of doing so. And I, you know, I just really don't see the need to, you know, really don't see the need to bind ourselves, you know, in this way. And I also wanted to just follow up for the record that I did have a conversation just last night with Representative Ernie Leidinger, whose service and experience I'm sure every member here completely respects. And yes, he did hear this in committee, and this piece and was not, in his opinion, really fully vetted. And when several of these issues that we've brought up today were brought to his attention, and, you know, asking for clarification about certain pieces of the bill, which I was beginning to read just yesterday, you know, he was very, very concerned about it. And so I just wanted to go on the record and correct that. So Thank you.
Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is basically just a comment, and I do appreciate the fact that, Representative Swatsky, that you're bringing this to our attention. But I'm also encouraged that it wasn't brought here because we're hearing a lot of military families saying, we have to have this. I think I'm proud to be in Minnesota, and I think Minnesota does a wonderful job in many different areas. Mm-hmm. And in this unsession, I'm seeing so many bills that are adding on to what we already do a super good job for. And what my concerns are that in joining a compact like this, we may possibly be muddying up what is already a really great system. And I don't want to have anybody interfere with what we do or change it, because I think we do see some instances where Minnesota has been at the top of our game, the top of the nation, and we're just not, we've kind of not been doing the best job in some of these areas. My concerns are we are just not going to be at the top of the game if we conform to a group that could possibly muddy up what we do well. And you know, I basically, it's just saddening. I'm just really proud to be a Minnesotan. We do so many things great, and we always have to conform to everybody else. And I'm not really that person who joins just because everybody else does. I think Minnesota is one of those states that many look forward to getting our opinion on because we do a great job. And with that, I would like to ask for a roll call. Thank you.
Roll call being asked for, that will be done. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just have a few more questions based on additional comments and questions. First of all, I'm wondering if either Representative Swatsky or Mr. Cordia could tell me if what the connection is with the Military Child Education Coalition, if you're familiar with that organization in any way.
Mr. Cordia.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I'm not familiar with that organization.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cordia, it's a military group that apparently is in support of Common Core, and they specifically talk about this compact. And that's why I guess the whole kind of Common Core thing and the Common Core question gives me some concern. Because while, you know, obviously the problem is, in my view, that the military kids are going from different states and they have different standards, and I understand how that would be very problematic, because if I were to have kids and have to put them in all these different school districts, and then one school the material was too advanced, another school my child was bored, I can see where that would be a problem, and you know, we definitely should look at a way to address that issue. But I feel that this goes above and beyond and provides unintended consequences, where I don't think that the members of the legislature have, you know, fully read this language and understand what some of the unintended consequences are. And my view is that the unintended consequences are is that I don't know how a school district can basically implement Common Core standards for just the military and what the resources would be to do that. Because I think that they're either going to implement those standards, we're going to require them to implement those standards, or we're not. If they're implementing those standards, they're going to have to be held for all students, because you can't have different standards for different students. And, you know, frankly, I agree with Representative Tice and Representative Pugh. You know, Minnesota has higher standards. I don't think that we should be sort of educating to the lowest common denominator. And so while I think the goal is, you know, a laudable one, we want to make sure that those military kids are educated, I don't know how this serves them. I don't know how this serves students at all, statewide, if we're going to be lowering our expectations. And particularly this question I asked before, how this, when we're just going to graduate students, whether or not they're able to meet our standards, I don't know how that helps any student. I think that this is an overstep, and I think that the immunity section and the force of law section is way over what we should be looking at here. And so, you know, I think that we really need to slow down and take a look at what we've got going here. And I think that, you know, the discussion should be if we're going to implement Common Core, because I think that what we might be doing here is implementing this program before we even consider in the proper committees what we're doing. So, members, I would encourage a no vote on this.
Representative Kahn.
Well,
you know, again, it is very simple to me what we're doing. We're facilitating the lives of military families that have been subjected to a lot of stress and are subjected to more stress as they move their kids through different systems. I am amazed that people would be, and remember, I carried an interstate compact bill once, and you can't change a word in it without it going back to be re-ratified by all of those 46 states and having them agree with it. And if members are comfortable with doing this snub into the face of the military, then I encourage you to vote no. I think that these 200 children or so that we're having and the kinds of issues that might come up are so small compared to the devastating, what could be a very bad effect of some irrational activity in some school district on a student. And I don't understand that there's any problem in saying that every student would then have to agree with something that one student has to do too. I'm just amazed that people could feel comfortable voting no on it, but go ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pappin.
Thank you. I want to respond to that because I don't view this as a snub to military in any way whatsoever. In fact, why we would want to, you know, dumb down standards for children of military, I have no idea. First of all, there's nothing that says we can't implement something in Minnesota that will have the same impact and same effect without forcing us to be liable under a compact situation. And I want to refer all members to, once again, Article 18. That says, all member states' laws conflicting with this compact are superseded to the extent of the conflict. That is a really, really big deal. That is very problematic. And, go ahead and vote how you want on this. Okay. I think it's a very bad idea for us to do so.
Representative Swatsky, my understanding is, and having seen another bill similar to this only having to do with licenses of spouses of members, these are coming out of work done by the First Lady, Michelle Obama, and our Lieutenant Governor working on this to try and make it easier for our military families that get transferred into our state. And this is what these bills are about.
Mr. Chair, yes, thank you very much. The day that the three gentlemen came from Washington, D.C., Rick Masters, Brigadier General Stephen Hogan, and Martin Dempsey, flew in, spent a couple days.
Representative Scottsy.
Spent a couple days with the Minnesota legislature and really took to heart what Minnesota is not part of right now within the 50 states within the United States of America. In no way, shape, or form, and I sit on education policy, did anybody in that committee question whether we were dumbing down their education. We were taking a military child that is coming to any district in the state of Minnesota and giving them an education from this day forward. From this day forward. Now, I'll give you a situation in my school. In my district, we teach seventh grade geography. But in a school district over, might teach eighth grade geography. Let's just use that analogy. If a student came and had that geography in another country, and so they couldn't, they'd have to take it twice because they took it in seventh grade in another country as a military student, and then they came to my district and they had to take it over again, we would not penalize them for not taking the other subject because of in seventh grade they should have had the other subject. Certainly, school districts also can work and say, hey, you've already had geography. You can take social studies in the seventh grade or eighth grade curriculum, social studies. This is something to welcome our military families. We had military children on the committee sitting listening to this testimony as well, and they were very grateful and were very, Jamal, in fact, is one of the legislative assistants, and he was a student that traveled from state to state or around the country, different countries. So I would appreciate, and I thank you for such a great
discussion on this. I will make sure that the department will certainly bring it back to the department. I will also make sure that the governor is well aware of some of the instances that you are very concerned about, and I would be very proud to continue with this compact for the state of Minnesota. Chair.
Anybody else in the audience that needs to speak for or against the bill? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 2569 be as amended.
Yes.
Be referred to this. No, it's like House File 2569 as amended be referred to the Committee on State Government, Finance, and Veterans Affairs. All in favor of the motion?
Roll call.
Oh, excuse me. There's a roll call being called for. The clerk will take the roll. Sorry.
Nelson?
Aye.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Thorholt?
Yes.
Falk?
Aye.
Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Yes.
Lean?
Aye.
Pugh?
Nope.
There being seven ayes and three nays, the motion's approved and the bill's referred. Thank you, Representative Sawoski, and happy Pi Day.
Thank you, and have a nice weekend.
Members, we have minutes. Representative Freiberg.
Yes, I'd like to move the voluminous minutes of the March 12th meeting.
All those in favor of the minutes of March 12th as written, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. And with that, members, we're adjourned.